Next matter is U.S. v. Chapman.
Oh, wait, where's an egg in there?
Good morning. My name is Candace Kane, and I represent Malachi Chapman. I asked to reserve 3 minutes.
I can't pass up the fact you must have grown up with this all of your life. Your name is Candy Kane?
Yes.
It's amazing.
I know. I was not born on Christmas.
I guess that you didn't want to go there. Go ahead.
I asked to reserve 3 minutes in rebuttal. May it please the court. This case is unusual in that neither counsel nor Mr. Chapman knew that he was about to be sentenced that day. And that's why we're asking for a remand. The denial of a short request...
You're not in your request, though. You're not suggesting that it should go to a different judge?
I would leave that to the next phase. But that should be considered, of course, I think. The denial of a short continuance that was requested here denied 3 rights. Allocution, rights under Rule 32, and due process. The allocution here really wasn't so much an allocution as it was sort of an offer of proof. Your Honor, I would have been able to bring in people, letters. I would have been able to express myself.
I had a letter. Himself.
Pardon me?
After all that, he did end up expressing himself.
Oh, he expressed himself. But one of the things that judges tell us is important at the trial court level is the defendant's expression of remorse. That's a very emotional, very thought-provoking type of presentation that needs consideration. And he didn't really have that chance here. The other thing that he did not have was the guiding hand of counsel, because counsel didn't know that he was about to be sentenced, and they hadn't talked about expressions of remorse.
How did this happen? How did this all come about in terms of counsel just showed up that day?
Well, the judge says on the record that counsel wrote the wrong date down.
Right, he said miscalendered it. But he was there at the court. He was there at the courthouse?
I think he was called in quickly and drove
to
the courthouse.
Okay.
My colleague is here. The prosecutor's here. He maybe knows that detail. I didn't ask counsel that. But it sounds like the case was called in the morning, and it really didn't start till noon, and that was probably to allow counsel to arrive at the courthouse. This is a courthouse in Williamsport, and I think that the driving distances are long. But in allocution, you know, here, as I said, he had mostly a proffer, unprepared, unguided statements. And one of the things that you get when you have notice is you have the chance to have an effective and personally persuasive presentation to the court. Rule 32 codified the ancient right of allocution, but it did more. It explained the purposes of allocution. One is to allow the defendant to offer mitigation. Two is to present personal characteristics that then allow the court to craft an individualized sentence.
Well, it's the two, and that was written before the age of pre-sentence reports. Two was satisfied, wasn't he? He had a chance for the personal characteristics to be communicated. In fact, the judge, when he went on to pronounce sentence, goes on at some length about the defendant's background and his personal characteristics.
Right. The judge also said there, I know what I think I need to know about your case. But how could he? He did not know what he didn't know, and he didn't allow Mr. Chapman to bring in the supporters. This person has a big extended family. He grew up in Williamsport, went to high school in Williamsport, so he had teachers in the area. We don't know what he would have been able to bring to court that day if he had an extension. He did say on the record, I had letters, I had family support, I had things I wanted to tell the court. One thing the Commonwealth comments on, I mean the government comments on, is that Mr. Chapman said he didn't know if what he had would persuade the court, so it must not have been, you know, worthwhile. That's the implication. But that's not it at all. Mr. Chapman was very polite, and he was telling the court, you know, I don't know what Your Honor will decide, but I want to present this to you. And that request was denied.
What do you make of this statement by the trial court? I think he says it twice. He says, the defendant's substantive rights, your substantive rights, Mr. Chapman, have not been affected by this oversight. Isn't that kind of putting the cart ahead of the horse? How can the court determine somebody's substantive rights haven't been affected when he doesn't know what, if anything, is going to be presented?
Exactly. I agree completely. And we know from the Adams case in 2001 that if there's a violation of a right and the opportunity existed for that violation to influence the outcome, then we have to have a new hearing. And here we had an opportunity for a lower sentence. Mr. Chapman was facing 40 years. He was sentenced to 16 years. The guidelines started at 15. I think they went to 19. But the plea agreement allowed him to ask for less, ask for 144 months, which is 12 years. But there's nothing in the plea agreement that would prevent the judge from going even lower if he was persuaded.
Of no practicality, given the record that the judge goes through, it's not likely that he would have gone below the 144, is it?
We don't know.
We don't know.
We know that the judge was, you know, holding Mr. Chapman to a standard that is what I think is unfair. And so we don't know what he would have done maybe on a different day, a better day. I don't know.
Well, before lunch. And there are studies that in London, in England, not here, but there are studies that show that can affect what happens in sentence, whether it's before lunch or after lunch.
Oh, yes, yes, that's right.
What do you make of Mr. Chapman at one point saying he never reviewed the PSI?
I think,
a short break.
Yeah.
And then he says, well, yeah, now I have reviewed it. I mean, the government may take the position that he didn't, in fact, have a chance to review the PSI.
Right. I think that it was reviewed maybe quickly or maybe by phone or
the
I don't
suggestion
really.
Was a phone call.
Right.
Well, before the sentencing, he may have gone over it with his attorney.
But right, and they may have talked about it on the phone.
I don't think that Chapman thought he adequately went over the PSI. It sounds like he was concerned about not having a chance.
Right.
And then the lawyer gets a chance to briefly chat with him.
No, I think that is a concern here.
He says we just never went over anything, Your Honor. Chapman says that.
That's right. Yes, I don't think he had a lot of time with counsel leading up to this, which is why I'm sure.
And it's interesting, the counsel in this case, didn't counsel argue for a sentence that would have violated the plea agreement?
That's right. He was caught off guard.
Counsel didn't even know we were supposed to be there that day?
That's right. He didn't know the date. He argued for a sentence that was prohibited. It was prohibited by the defense to ask for. But he didn't know that the sentencing was to occur. And for all those reasons.
He brought the whole package.
I'm sorry?
He brought the whole package.
Yes. Yes. But for all those reasons, we're asking for a remand. And if the court now is inclined to assign it to different court, that would be our request as well.
Thank you. Mr. Hartzell? All the years I've known you, is it Rocketshell? Rocketshell or Rocketshell?
Rocketshell.
Did I ever get it right in all these years?
Don't answer that.
I'll answer to anything these days, Your Honor. And may it please the court, George Rocketshell on behalf of the United States. Our
Did
position.
You defend this? What happened here?
Well, I think I'm obligated to.
Well, you're obligated to. There's an incredible advocate sitting behind you who knows when to fold, when to hold them, when to fold them.
And that's certainly a good adage to live by. But in this case, under the applicable precedent, Judge Brand did not act arbitrarily in denying
the... What precedent are you referring to?
I'm referring to the Alfano case.
And Alfano says that a defendant who apparently at least makes the representation that he has family that would come into court doesn't have the right to have family come into court as part of his right of allocution?
No, but it does prescribe the standard by which we judge a judge's abuse of discretion in denying a continuance request, and Alfano applied that standard to a sentencing issue. And on the question of arbitrariness, Judge Brand had...
Was it allocution?
I beg your pardon?
Was it allocution, the sentencing issue?
No, it dealt with swearing in a witness, but it stands for the proposition that there's not an unlimited right to allocution. There's not an unlimited right to present witnesses at a sentencing proceeding. And in this case, Judge Brand had delayed the sentencing for an extended period of time. The defendant had an ample period of time to prepare for sentencing, and contrary to the suggestion...
Is there any dispute that the defendant did not know that sentencing was that day?
Well, obviously he knew enough, Judge Vanaski, to prepare a letter that got filed with the court 3 days before the sentencing.
They sent letters in at any particular time, but is there any dispute that when he showed up that his lawyer did not tell him that it was going to be sentencing that day, the lawyer had miscalendered it? Did the lawyer have to be called, summoned to be there?
He did have to be called. I think the district judge noted that there was some oversight in the way he misread the scheduling order for that date.
What do you make of the district court, not once, but twice, saying your rights are not going to be violated, so we're going to go ahead and sentence you, not knowing what, if anything, would be presented? How can he, is he clairvoyant? He's telling, nothing you say or do is going to change my mind, is what he's saying.
I don't read the record quite that way, Judge Respect.
He says there's nobody to know. He said that.
He says at least twice.
I think it does show that the judge was sensitive to the need to balance the defendant's substantive rights and the potential for prejudice with the request for the continuance and the need to move the sentencing forward. I actually think it shows some sensitivity and the need to balance those rights rather than a judge that was cavalierly saying, I'm just going to ignore your rights and go forward with the sentencing today.
How can you be more cavalier than saying, it's my intention to proceed, your substantive rights aren't going to be violated?
Yeah, I know.
And not knowing what, if anything, is being presented.
I think he also said that he wasn't going to proceed or he would not have proceeded if he believed that the defendant's substantive rights were going to be violated.
That's before any argument is made as to, look, I have X, Y, and Z to present to you. He's saying this in a vacuum, not knowing what, if anything, is going to be presented. So he really isn't that putting the cart ahead of the horse?
This defendant did not say this is X, Y, and Z or provide any kind of detail concerning what these additional witnesses
were. He said my family would be here. He said that.
He did, but he also described in detail his family background in his letter and in his allocution. He described his background as someone who was the son of two drug addicts who had
his father's house, right? I'm sorry, as you know, I sentenced, when I was a town police court judge, hundreds of defendants, maybe same as this morning, maybe even close to going into thousands. I cannot conceive of sentencing a defendant without hearing from the family. When the defendant says, my family wants to be here, and it's going to cost me a week's continuance, I cannot comprehend proceeding to that sentencing, not hearing from the defendant's family. No matter how notorious the guy's record is, his record is horrendous. He's a career criminal offender. I'm not sure I'd be able to see that. If I sentenced, especially at this kind of time, a defendant, and I knew that his father, who maybe could be incredibly informative because his father's walked down the same path himself, whoever it is in his family, wanted to be there, and I'm taking 16 years of this guy's life and I haven't heard from this guy's family, but that, I boggles my mind that any judge would do that.
Well, in the Alfano case, actually, this court indicated that there was nothing in the record to show that any of the people the defendant indicated were going to appear and speak.
That wasn't a sentencing issue. That was not a sentencing issue, and Prono filed out now. When the defendant said, my family wants to be here before you sentence me. Totally different. That was witnesses. But it wasn't going to the right of allocation. And it wasn't a one-week 7 days, 5 working days continuance. That's all he's asking for. Give me 5 days, Judge, to get my function here. I don't know if it'll help me, but they support me, and maybe it'll help me, maybe it won't, but I want you to hear what they have to say.
Go ahead. The other thing that concerns me is his rather cavalier attitude with respect to the PSI. So the Chapman did two occasions says, I didn't have a chance to review with my attorney. Twice he says that. So the judge takes what looks like a very brief recess, and we all know how long and complicated a PSI is, particularly in a case where the guy's a career offender. And they go back on the record, and he doesn't even ask if he understood the PSI. The colloquy, Your Honor, we had a brief discussion by telephone, nothing in person, but we had a brief discussion by telephone. And then the court goes into his business about there are just two objections, but never asks him, do you understand the pre-sentence report? I mean, there's no conversation about that.
I think the judge did question the defendant about whether he had reviewed the pre-sentence report. I think that's why we have counsel to represent defendants and look at pre-sentence reports and help them to understand some of the finer points of them.
Yeah, he says, I don't know what objections you're stating. This is the defendant. I don't know what objections you're stating. We had a brief discussion on the phone, nothing in person. And he's asked by the judge, do you have an opportunity to review the PSI? No, Your Honor. I mean, are you kidding me with this?
No, I'm not kidding you. At some point, though, he was given an opportunity to consult with counsel, and then the district court asked him after that opportunity to consult with counsel if he had, in fact, reviewed it with counsel.
Never asked him if he understood it?
But I grant you that the record doesn't precisely say that.
This says nothing about it.
He was not asked if he understood it. That's absolutely correct.
You know, finally, at the end of the subsection C, where Judge Greenberg discusses the abuse of discretion for denying the request of continuance, we said even if the sentencing judge did not arbitrarily, there is nothing in the record. So, in other words, assuming there's a wonder that there wasn't a denial of abuse of discretion, nothing in the record to show that any person had actually agreed to submit a letter to a fine. Alfano's behalf, very, very different. Moreover, there's no reason to believe that these letters have written would have helped Alfano with sentencing. We see no abuse of discretion in denying the continuance request. So what we're saying is, but if there's nothing in the record to suggest that the person would have agreed to write the letter, even if the continuance was requested, had been granted.
We don't have that here either.
My family wanted to be here. He said that.
But to this day, we don't have any copy of the letter he said they were going to submit.
Well, why would he
say
the district court doesn't have jurisdiction to hear the letter now, to read the letter now. We have the case. And I'm not talking about the letter. I'm talking about a family member coming into court where the defendant said, it may or may not be true, that the family wanted to be here, that somebody would have been there. I know some of us have imposed sentences. I cannot tell you what it's like to impose a sentence on somebody and there's no family member there. My first homicide sentencing, I can't remember what it was, but it was a whole lot of years. And from the time the trial began to the time the sentence was pronounced, there was no family member. The only person who supported that kid, who was a kid, was his attorney. To this day, it impacts me that this kid had 40 years of his life and probably more taken away, and no one ever stood by that kid's side. It can make a difference. It doesn't necessarily make a difference, as Chapman admitted, but to a lot of judges, it can make a difference. He deserved the right to argue down to 144 months. That's still a lot of time. The sentencing judge said, here, another thing kind of blows my mind, this is the only sentence that will serve my purposes of imposing sentence, which is also incredibly cavalier. How can it be the only sentence? So he gets 16 years. That's saying that 15 years and a half wouldn't serve the purpose of the sentence. 15 years wouldn't meet the purpose of the sentence. 12 years wouldn't do it. That's kind of a ridiculous statement. There's always more than one sentence when it comes to incarceration and the terms of incarceration that will meet the objectives of the sentence. But the judge seems to think that he's set upon the one perfect sentence. He knows what he has to know to impose the sentence. He imposes the perfect sentence. Let's move on to the next case.
Well, Judge McKee, would you like me to comment on that?
If you want to, sure.
Well, I would say this on behalf of the district court's statement that it was the only sentence. It was prefaced by a recitation of the fact that he had reviewed the pre-sentence report. He identified salient facts from the report and identified his review of the Section 3553A factors. And I believe, read in that context, the district court was stating that his review resulted in that being the appropriate sentence under the review of all the circumstances in the case.
So what do you make of his allocution? I mean, where he says, but like, I don't know about this, so I'm just kind of caught off guard right now. I know I'm rambling. I'm caught off guard, really, Your Honor. So he really had no idea he was about to get a 16-year sentence.
That's what the defendant consistently said that from the moment the sentence started. But the district court obviously believed that the defendant had reviewed more of the record and more of the pre-sentence report than he let on.
But he said he didn't. He said he didn't review the pre-sentence report. Twice he says that.
But that is what he said.
What the court said before is, the sentence I'm about to impose is the only one sufficient to satisfy Section 3553A factors outlined above. He didn't even outline all the 3553A factors above. He outlined all the 3553 factors that go to the characters of the offender and the offense, but he didn't go to the other things set forth in there. He says it's the lowest sentence consistent with his objectives that will meet the objectives of 3553A, including rehabilitative needs of the defendant. But there's nothing to suggest that he really considered it, because the entire thing is taken up with his recitation of the defendant's horrendous record. And it is a horrendous record, starting from, I think it was 12 or 15 when he first got in trouble. It's a horrible record. How old was he at the time of sentencing, do you know?
I believe he was 29, Your Honor.
You know what else I found interesting? This is really not of the moment, but that when the judge goes on this discussion to satisfy, when he rules on the objections, he cites a series, literally a series of NPOs, non-precedential opinions. Did you find that unusual?
Not necessarily.
Okay. So that's pretty typical there?
Well,
they
don't
cite non-precedential opinions to support their legal
analysis? I believe it was the district court endorsing perhaps the reasoning of those non-precedential opinions as opposed to relying on them as actual, you know, authority issued by this court. If there are no other questions, Your Honor, I see my time's rapidly growing short. Thank you.
You get the same 60 seconds per minute that she does. It's not going this short that rapidly.
Thank you, Your Honor.
If the court has no other questions, I will...
Wise move.
Yes. I will skip rebuttal.
All right, thank you. Thank you. We'll take the matter of advisement. We thank counsel for their argument.